Leading up to Easter, and obviously after next weekend, we'll be into Palm Sunday, and then it's Easter itself. So, you know, we're moving ahead towards Easter now. But this season is also a challenging season for us financially, and we have higher goals in this season for our finances. So thank you to everybody for giving so generously. Let's keep it up. We're on course, but, you know, we just need to keep going there. But thank you to all of you. And thank you, too, for being so engaged in this series and so engaged in this, these issues of social justice. We're hearing some really great reports back from the challenge groups that are meeting after the service. They'll be meeting again today, and from some of the discipleship groups. And I think this is always challenging because it's, you know, injustice is something that is always there. You know, we address it, but it doesn't go away. I mean, we make progress, obviously, around things. We heard a little bit about that last week. But I think sometimes it can feel like we're having to talk about it and talk about it and talk about it and act. And staying the course can be a challenge. You know, I just want to say thank you to you as a community, because we're involved in numerous things. Again, we saw some of them there in that video, where we've stayed the course for quite some time, and it's taken time, but we're beginning to see some fruit. Again, we'll share a little bit more about that later on in the service. But this whole concept of staying in the course is really what we're going to focus on today, because the title for today is Finding Our Niche. And it's really, as I said, it's the last one in the talking part of this series. We'll actually go out and serve next week. But we want to look at how, you know, if we're struggling to engage, if we're struggling to find a place where we can be activistic, where we can take action around injustice, how do we find that niche? How do we get in a place where we can start moving forward? We can start being productive. And you know, this sense of niche, we're going to use a sort of ecological metaphor, ecological theme, really, for this the topic today. We often look at nature, right? We often turn there for our metaphors, and I think it's fitting for this one in particular, because as we look at the issues of injustice, just like nature, we realize that as humanity, as a planet, as a you know, the whole planet, we're all interconnected. We're all one system ultimately, and what we do here affects what happens over there, and vice versa. And I've been part of the youth challenge group, not because I've been helping lead it, not because I'm youthful. And it's been really interesting hearing some of the high schoolers and some recent graduates talking about issues of injustice. And we've been looking at numerous things, but noticing how interconnected everything is. So some people have been sharing some of the things that really concern them the most. Some of that is around issues of race and voting rights and things like that, and issues of gender and the pay gap, gender pay gap. And as we look at all those things, we see racism at work, we see sexism at work, and we want to address those things. But we also see just economic injustice at work. Like if you can pay somebody less because they're a woman and get away with it, there's a lot of people that are going to do that, right? And it's ultimately sexist, but perhaps the main motivation is your own self-interest and your own financial self-interest. Same with racism. If you think about there's a racist resistance to the abolition of slavery, but there was a huge economic resistance to it, right? If you can actually get somebody to do work for nothing, I mean, talk about pay gap there, then why on earth would you want to start having to pay people for doing a fair day's work? So there are these economic forces that we are all subject to as well, right? Because we all like cheap products. We all like to consume things at minimal cost. And we might be more conscious of that and more aware of that than we are who ultimately has paid the price to get that product to us at a cheap cost. Is somebody being paid a fair wage? Are their working conditions just? What impact is there on the environment for us consuming such cheap products, et cetera, et cetera? So, you know, we're becoming aware, more and more aware of our interconnectedness and the way injustice in one place is a threat to justice in another place, to misquote Martin Luther King. So today we're looking at the sort of the ecosystem of justice, if you like, or injustice, but we're also looking at ourselves in that ecosystem of activism. And noticing that actually just as injustice is connected, so justice can be connected. In other words, as we work for justice in one place, maybe a small place, it has a much bigger effect on the whole system. We can address these system issues by each of us doing our part, each of us playing our part. So we're kind of looking at how can we find our niche? What is our part in the ecosystem of activism, if you like? What is our place there? And can we find a place, just like in the natural world, where it's not just about what we're contributing, but it's also what we're drawing from? It's seeing ourselves in partnership in that system, not separate from it, but rather contributing from it and also sustaining ourselves from it so that we don't get burnt out. Okay, so we're just going to talk a little bit about that this morning, and then we're going to hear from a couple of other people as well. But first of all, I just want to throw out, we're going to look at three scriptures really quickly, some kind of philosophical givens that we should take into this as we think about how are we going to take action. Okay, and this might especially be relevant to us if we're already taking action and maybe feeling a little tired or a little jaded. First one is this, and this is a scripture we quote from very regularly, and I think the reason is because we have to keep coming back to the fact that it's very easy for us to get into religion and have the weight of we've got to do this rather than we get to do this. We get into the sort of religious pressure rather than the Jesus freedom. And so perhaps we need releasing from the chains of religion as much as anything. Come to me, this is Jesus, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. What this speaks of to me is no guilt, right? Let's just remove guilt from our shoulders. Let's just let it slide off as we think about all the challenges out there, all the injustices out there, and our response to it. We can find our niche by just letting go of guilt, right? And not that being this forced pressure. You plant a seed in the ground, the seed is taking nurture and life and health from the soil. It's not consciously thinking, oh, I better grow, I better perform my function as a particular flower or a particular plant, right? So again, I think the ecosystem analogy helps. In that light, another scripture, Jesus also said in John chapter 15, I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If you do not remain in me, you're like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. In other words, they only have very limited use. So this is Jesus saying, look, I mean, Jesus was constantly talking about drawing life from the Spirit of God. He used metaphors like Father for God, of this intimate connection. And Jesus is saying to his followers, you need that same connection. You need that nurture. You need a life-giving force. You need something that you can draw from, because that's what's going to sustain you. So as we think about activism, as we think about engaging in injustice, we need to take care of ourselves. We need to own our own selves and recognize that we too need care. So firstly, so we don't burn out, and secondly, because as we take care of ourselves, as we receive more love, we're able to give more love more effectively. We cease to operate out of guilt, or proving ourselves, or having to be right, or whatever else might motivate a more anxious response to injustice. And then thirdly, let's never despise small things. Like most of us in this room, I was having this conversation with somebody just a couple of days ago. Most of us in this room, here's a sobering thought, will probably be completely forgotten in two or three generations, right? That's the motivation for today. The one sort of, hope that really inspires you. But what I mean is, some people make this phenomenal mark on history, right? And books get written about them, and we quote them, and their names. Probably most of us, I certainly think that's going to be true of me, that's not going to be the case. We get, most of us, I mean, the vast majority of the people on the planet are going to do small things, but those small things count. Jesus talked in parables about this subject. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all the seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree so that the birds come and perch in its branches. So We get to do small things that can become big things, and cumulatively over time, as we work at them and are faithful to them and other people join with us in them, we can be productive and make an impact, make a difference. So I think very often what keeps us from doing something is we're looking to do a big thing, or we think, I'm not really making any difference. Why would I do that? Rather than thinking, okay, this I can do that. It's doable, and I'm going to do it, and it's going to have an impact, and I'm going to see the power of something small and really value something small and value the small things that other people are doing and see the significance in that. So those are some sort of, I guess, some philosophical parameters that when we think about this ecosystem. But I just want to run through, and we've just got 4 points that are going to come up here. What could we bear in mind as we go about finding our niche? And I think these are perhaps most helpful for those of us that might be sort of on the verge of doing something, not quite sure what to do. Most of these are pretty obvious. But I think if we bear them in mind, it might lead us to a small thing or to some kind of action that we can take. So just 4 points about how can we find our niche? Well, let's think, what moves us with compassion, right? Jesus was a compassionate person. So in the Gospels are full of examples of this. I think we've got a little quote here. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. So Jesus, when Jesus got up in the morning, he wasn't thinking, oh, what's my to-do list today? Heal a few people, feed a few people, annoy some religious people. Jesus is kind of motivated from compassion, from what he sees around him. So we're all stirred and moved. You know, that word, we've said this many times before, that word, Jesus was moved with compassion. It's really, in the Greek, it's talking about guts being stirred. It's kind of very, it's splanknik, that's where we get that word from. It's deep, he's really moved. And so what naturally moves us? Certain injustices stir us up. That is a pretty good cue for us, I think, that perhaps that's something we should be doing something about. Secondly, how can our unique persona blossom? In other words, we all bring different things to the table. Paul, the early church leader who kind of wrote much of the New Testament, the Christian scriptures, he was constantly going on about this, this issue of the uniqueness of the individual, but the togetherness of community and the power of all that unique individuality coming together to create something even more beautiful. God's various gifts are handed out everywhere, but they all originate in God's Spirit. That's where they come. There's this unity. God's various ministries are carried out everywhere, but they all originate in God's Spirit. God's various expressions of power are in action everywhere, but God himself is behind it all. Each person is given something to do that shows who God is. Everyone gets in on it. Everyone benefits. All kinds of things are handed out by the Spirit to all kinds of people. So there's this sense of unity. There's this sense of it's part of what God is. God, we are part of God. Together we form this spiritual dynamic. But we're all individuals as well. So we've got to think through, what do we bring? You might be more behind the scenes kind of person. You know, you might not be somebody who wants to be super outspoken. You might be somebody who can speak up and speak out publicly and so take stands on things. You might be more of an organizer or more of an administrator. You might have certain skills or experience or gifting that you don't even really have to try at. And here's the tricky thing, I think, with these kinds of things is we all think everybody else is like us. Right, so what comes naturally to us, we don't even really value it because we think, well, isn't everybody like that? Well, actually, no. So valuing ourselves and what we bring and thinking, actually, that can be applied to issues of injustice. I don't have to reinvent myself or be somebody else or try to be somebody else. So think through, okay, what have I got and what can I bring and where might that be most suitably applied? Thirdly, who do we want to collaborate with? Okay, so this is a relational piece. There are probably people in our lives who are already engaged in activism or engaged around issues, and we like them, and we think they're fun to be around, and they're good people. That's a pretty good sign. Maybe we should join with them. that, you know, that, because that would be sustainable, right? That would be, you know, we don't want to be on our own. We don't want to be isolated. I mean, there's something very obvious about this. Ecclesiastes kind of, you know, very pithily hits this one on the head. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls down who has no one to help them up. So there's a practicality to this. We don't want to be on our own. We don't want to be isolated. We need relational connection, right? That's part of this nurture. That's part of this system. And it means we don't have to carry all the weight. Where, oh, the whole, you know, this, whatever the issue is, it's like, it's all down to me and me showing up and me doing it all. If we're doing it in partnership with other people and seeing part, that as an essential part of this ecosystem, we don't have to carry all the weight. But there's another side to this too, which is that the people we're serving or people that we're engaging with we are in relationship with those people too, right? We're all part of this. We perhaps should see less of the I am the server and that's a needy person that I'm serving, but rather we're part of the same system and we're working together to bring about justice, to bring about love, to bring about something else. So who do you feel drawn to? Who are the people that you perhaps naturally navigate towards, migrate towards? And then fourthly, where do we sense the Spirit leading, right? So, you know, there's this, you know, in all of this, if we're part of God and if we're being drawn and motivated by love, then we're probably, it would behove us to kind of maybe sit back a little bit, and especially at the end of a series like this, and just think, well, okay, where do I sense love drawing me? Where do I sense God prompting me? Let's look at another scripture that I think you know, touches on this, but what this is, Jesus talking about his connection to God and the kind of connection that we can have to God. But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth. He will not speak on his own. He will speak only what he hears, and he will tell you what is yet to come. So there's this sense of guidance. I mean, we could talk about that for quite a long time, but how do we respond to guidance? And how do we discern where the Spirit might be leading us? Well, some of that, I think, is just it's somewhat intuitive, and we will feel led. You know, we have hunches, or we feel perhaps all those things, the sense of compassion, relational connection, who I am and my wiring, it cumulatively leads us in a particular direction or seems to be leading us there. Let's respond to that. Let's not resist it or pull back from it. So we have, there's just some practical helps, hopefully, for us, especially if we're perhaps struggling to move forward, struggling to take a step. They aren't saying, none of those are saying what we should do, but how we might go about determining what we should do. Now, I wanted to share with you at this point, we're talking about today us finding our niche, right? And we're talking about that at the moment on an individual basis. But as a church, we also are finding our niche, right? As we look at the world and we respond to different needs in the world, and one of our challenges has always been, especially I think when you have a community of people with lots of compassion and lots of perspectives, it's hard to focus and decide which one do we choose, where do we go, and how do we stay focused without becoming too diffused and having less impact that way. How do we find those small things together as a church community? But over the years, I think we have found our niche and we're beginning to grow. And I wanted to run through some things. We're going to, you know, some pictures are going to come up here. But I just wanted to, just for a few minutes here, just recap and share some of the ways that we as a church community are engaging in the world. And I think in increasingly significant ways, around justice issues, and again in keeping with this idea of an ecosystem, in increasingly interconnected and overlapping and synergistic ways. And as we go through some of these things, like I've put a list together that I actually found hard to turn into a list, because, well, that's a, you know, this issue is a little bit of that and it's a little bit of the other thing as well. You know, it's like hard to separate all the things out because they do overlap so much, which I think is a really good thing. But let's think about our farm. Okay, we started farming, I don't know, 10, 11 years ago, and we've we're gaining momentum with that farm. We're not just producing more food. I mean, that's important, but we're getting traction around issues of food justice. We're working with Montgomery County and Mano, as we heard in that in one of the videos. I think it was the week before last. Our connection to Mano in terms of food distribution. We're providing people with fresh fruit and vegetables who would not normally have access to that. So some really wonderful things going on there. But we're also getting the attention of the county now. Ruth and the farm team have done an amazing job of getting the word out about how anybody can come and volunteer on our farm. So we have all kinds of people from all walks of life, young people, older people, coming and serving on our farm, which is a wonderful thing. The whole community beginning to work together. And as we're doing that, people are taking notice. And, you know, we recently, as part of a grant application for the farm to Montgomery County, they were talking to us about, could you maybe work in certain other kinds of ways? They're asking us to do things, and we're weighing all that up at the moment. But they see us as significant in terms of food justice issues in the area. Now, I don't say that to say, oh, aren't we fantastic? But what it means is, over time, as we're finding our niche there, we're making an impact and an increasingly large impact. And that's a beautiful thing. Guatemala, we've been working and serving in Guatemala and that partnership for, again, probably about 9 or 10 years now, faithfully working around issues to do with education, some medical help as well, and but really focusing very much on the relational aspect of this and not seeing the other as less than us, and we've come to solve all your problems, but seeing it as a partnership. And we're beginning, this year we've been reviewing some of our activity there and looking to really expand and broaden our base there in the town of Ipala where we work. Also looking to broaden and expand what we're doing here in terms of especially work around immigration justice. You know, we had that documentary last year that we screened here and had folks talk about that, and that's an issue we're going to keep coming back to. And it's interesting that immigration is sort of an integrated or a connected issue to do with Greencastle School, the elementary school just down the road from us where we've been serving. Many of the needs in that high poverty school are around immigration issues or people without documentation who are struggling for asylum or to get their documentation sorted out and can't claim some of the help that they really need. And we're trying to help people with food, and we've got that backpack program that's been going for some time. But also we're helping around advocacy issues. So we've been advocating for after-school programs with Greencastle, which then led us, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, we got the attention of Montgomery County Public Schools because we've been doing other work around education. Our racial justice team put on an amazing education workshop back in November, Racial Justice in Education. We looked at the issues, especially with a focus on Montgomery County, had all kinds of people come, people from Montgomery County Public Schools, people from the Board of Education. And we weren't in any way saying we're experts. We kind of brought experts in to talk about it, but we were saying that because we had decided as a church community that justice in education was important for us, especially around issues of race. We had a forum some 3 years ago that many of you participated in, and that was one of the issues. And it's taken us time as we've worked at that, and the racial reconciliation team have been working hard behind the scenes. It culminated in that workshop. And then the superintendent of Montgomery County Public Schools asked us if we would work with them in the cluster of schools represented by Paint Branch, the high school Paint Branch, and the associated middle and elementary schools. We were invited to work with them to engage the local faith communities in that area to help support, serve, advocate for public schools. Especially with issues of justice in mind. So we had a meeting here just a few weeks ago where all the principals, vice principals, the PTA presidents from all those schools came here, and we facilitated a discussion to identify needs. And we're now engaging with other faith communities to connect with that and to work out, okay, how can we respond? What are ways we can work together? So a lot of that is around come out of our education work, our work with racial justice. You know, that's been going on where we're trying to grow in our awareness of injustice, and then also that's taking us even sort of broader into faith work. You know, we've been crossing faith barriers to reach out with love and acceptance, and Unfortunately, sometimes this has been as a result of shootings and some of the tragedies that have happened where we've gathered with our Jewish friends in synagogue to after the shooting in Pittsburgh, or with our Muslim friends after the shooting in Christchurch. But also we're working together positively for the good of the community. We saw some examples of that in the video just now. And our interfaith work is meaning that we're able to have a reach beyond ourselves. We're able to make an impact beyond ourselves, an impact that we're not going to get the credit for, but that doesn't matter. We're working for the good of this planet, for the good of our part, our piece of this planet. So as we're engaging, we're going to be working hopefully with more and more faith communities around here, especially as we look to serve schools. And then, of course, next week we're going to have our day of service, and we're making these days of service interfaith. Each one is an interfaith event. We're inviting our friends and neighbours from local churches and mosques and synagogues to come. It's small beginnings, but it's mostly us, but more and more people are coming and engaging. And we've got this event next week, which is it's normal service next week, apart from we'll gather earlier at 9 for a potluck breakfast, and then we'll go out and serve on projects together as part of our worship service. It's a normal Sunday like any other Sunday for us in that sense. And Tineke is coordinating that event. She's just going to quickly come up and share a few things with us about next week and ways you can get involved.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. So Matthew kind of shared what I was going to share, actually, so I'm going to go back and sit down, because really, I was just going to share, if most of you have already experienced a day of service, in lieu of our regular Sunday, we gather early at 9 o'clock. We have a breakfast, potluck breakfast together, so please bring something to share with your friends. We'll hang together for about 45 minutes, and then we'll send you out into the community to serve both projects that will be off campus and projects that will be here on campus. We've got a good list going. We've made some changes, so if you've signed up, there haven't been a lot of signups yet on the website, so I'm going to be out in the lobby. If you have any questions or if you want to look at the signups, or I can walk you through. We've had a couple of changes in projects a little bit last minute. But most of them will be geared towards working with our partners already, Greencastle, Manna, Interfaith Works, Sophia's House, doing projects both here and off campus. And then we'll have a few other projects that are kind of geared towards Earth Day, since that's coming up too. So we'll be doing a lot of cleanup streams and trails. One thing I wanted to share, Matthew said that staff and people here have been inviting our partners in the community at mosques, churches, and synagogues to join us. But we've also this year, there's been kind of a same thing that Matthew was saying. With our relationships going year after year, we've made friends out in the community who have learned to trust us now. So Greencastle Elementary School in particular, I've been working with their principal and their linkages to learning coordinator. There's a new staff person there. And they've reached out to families and staff. So families at the school and staff at the school are going to join us here for the potluck, and then also back on their campus to work on some projects at school, which is huge, because opening up the school building and working on the campus on a Sunday morning is extra for staff and for families to come out. So it's kind of neat that we're inspiring the local community to also take part and take ownership of their property. So I'm very excited about that. If you'd like to sign up, I'd love for you to go look at the website. The link should come up on the banner right in the beginning when you first go to crcc.org. Look through the list, see what inspires you, sign up for a project, and this is a great time to invite your friends and neighbors, coworkers, or reach out to somebody and bring them along with us to serve in a really practical, on-the-ground way. So again, my name is Tineke. If you have any questions, I'll be out in the lobby after the service.
Thanks, Tineke. So I wanted to, that sort of stuff that we're doing as a church, right? They're community things. I want to come back to the more individual focus, what ways we can each respond to this challenge about injustice in the world. And I want to introduce you to a friend of mine, John Crownapple, who's going to come up and just share some of his story. I'm going to let him introduce himself, but I want you to welcome John. He's going to share a little bit about his own life, his own experience, in ways that I think could be really beneficial for all of us. So let's welcome John.
Good morning, everyone. So my name is John Cronapple, and for the past 25 years almost, I've been an educator. I live in Howard County, I work in Howard County, and I've also had the opportunity to work with school systems and groups across the country and in Canada. The past 15 plus years, my work as an educator has been focused in on social justice, educational equity, diversity and inclusion, and I've always considered my work to be anti-racism work, although it's been called different things throughout the years. Sometimes it's referred to as cultural competence training, cultural proficiency workshops. Some people might reduce it to something like, oh, he's a diversity trainer. I don't think that language quite captures the magnitude of the work. But you get the feel for what I've been involved in, education around the issues that we're exploring here with social justice. So the whole idea of finding your niche, I want to tell a little bit of my journey or share a little bit of my journey to illustrate, I think, a point that I think is important here, that sometimes with social justice activism, the issues are so large and grand and daunting, it sometimes seems like we need to go out there and do something big, where we might miss the opportunity to respond with compassion to what's right in front of us, where taking action from where we are. So that's really what I'd like to talk about here, is the foundational piece of essentially liberating ourselves from the systems of injustice around us. Because focusing on going out and doing something out there might be risky in terms of perceiving ourselves as outside of the system, outside of the issues. So I'll get here back on the ground with my story. What I've been focused on the past few years is the concept of dignity, human dignity. And I've been inspired by the work of someone out of Harvard University. Her name's Donna Hicks. And she spent her whole career focusing on not on education, but on conflict and international affairs. So she'll go into conflict zones and help nations, individuals, groups resolve the conflict. And from about 3 decades of this work, she realized that all human conflict emerges from violations of dignity or perceived violations of dignity. They're really the same thing. So her work has really been inspiring to me because she's taken the stance that what we need to do is learn to act with dignity. In other words, make it a verb. The way she defines it is really interesting. It's two parts. The first part is equal human worth and value. Basically, we all have dignity because we're human. We're all formed, you know, in the image of God. So we all have it. It's not something you can earn, and it's not something you can lose. We have it. We can do two things, though. We can either honor dignity or violate it. And those are the only two things we can do in our human relationships. And I've realized that, you know, over the past 2 decades, that social justice work, equity work, it's all relationship work at a macro level. So in any opportunity for choice to exercise our free will, we can do one of two things: violate dignity or honor it. Even when that comes to our own dignity, we can violate and honor our own dignity. We can violate and honor the dignity of one another, and we can honor or violate the dignity of something larger than all of us. So how this applies to my work here, oh, let me mention also there's a second part to that definition, and this part is really, really important. So dignity also means an inner state of peace that comes with the recognition of not only the value, but the vulnerability of all living things. So why that part of the definition is so important is because not all of us are equally vulnerable at any given point in time. In an unjust system, some of us, because of the identities that we show up with, are more vulnerable more often. So this gets me back to how I've focused in on changing the way I do my work on a day-to-day basis, because I've recognized almost 15 years ago that I was leading workshops where I was asking people to open up, share their wounds around things like racism, sexism, heterosexism, xenophobia, etc., and engage in reflection and dialogue, all to elevate critical consciousness. And I was asking people to share their stories, and I realized that I wasn't showing up with the vulnerability that I was asking other people to show up with. As someone who is using my, I guess, power seat as a teacher, as someone who was a perceived leader in that environment, I wasn't showing up with the vulnerability that I could. And the reason why that was so important to me at that point in time is because I'm someone who immediately, based on my markers of difference, will be perceived and categorized as white, as male. When I show up at work, middle class. When I show up with my life partner, Aaron, I'll be perceived as heterosexual. Cisgender, able-bodied, pretty much check them all off, and that's me. So as someone with those identities, I have the option to opt in and out of vulnerability a lot, whereas some of the folks I'm working with don't. So I realized that really, unless I was going to start opening up and exploring my issues, my identity, my involvement in systems of injustice, really I had no business leading the work. At least that's the conclusion I came to. So one day I showed up to work with my partner, my facilitator partner, Razia, and I said, hey, I'm going to try something different today. I'm going to introduce this activity a little bit different. Hang in there with me. I don't know how it's going to go, but just know that I'm going to be working on stretching myself here. And what I did that day is a frame, I think, that would work for all of us, to help us work with and for dignity, no matter what we're doing. You know, your job doesn't have to be a social justice educator. I mean, we're talking about anything that you do, that you spend your time doing, from vocations to jobs to parenting to neighboring, if that's a verb, I don't know. But no matter what we're doing, how can we do it with and for dignity? With meaning right here and now with our relationships. For meaning, you know, the kind of the purpose and the cause and everything around social justice. So the frame works like this. How can I work with people more often instead of doing things to people or for people? So that helps me with, especially when I'm in a situation where I have perceived power or I have power conferred to me, how can I partner with folks more often? How can I partner with my kids more often? How can I partner with my wife more often? How can I partner with the folks that are right here around me? Because that is compassion and engaging with compassion with what's right in front of us. But it's so, so easy to do things for people, especially my kids, or to people, especially with a busy schedule and all these things that need to be done. It's hard to slow down sometimes and talk about things in a way that, you know, would be more aligned with partnership. So that's the simple frame that I'm talking about here. How can we do things more with people and less to people or for people? So on this particular day, I got up, and it was an exercise I had done hundreds of times. I asked people to think about their name, how they experience their name, and how they believe other people experience their name. And then I'd ask them to think about their culture. How do you experience your culture, and how do you believe other people experience your culture? And so usually I would introduce it by saying something about my last name, Crown Apple, and I'd say how long it is and how sometimes it doesn't fit on forms, and maybe even a little bit about, you know, how the meaning behind it has kind of been lost, and I kind of attribute that to racism in terms of if there's any Germanness to it, World War II kind of being a place where people hid the meaning behind it. But it seems so superficial the way I would introduce this exercise. On this particular day, I told my partner, Razia, that I was going to try something different. And so I'm going to share a little bit of what I shared that day. So I said, you know, my first name is what I'm going to focus on today. My name is John. I was assumed that I was named after my father, and he's here today, John Crown Apple. It makes sense, right? For most of my life, that was just an assumption that I lived with. And then until I started exploring it a little bit more deeply, I was actually named after John the Baptist, which my mom picked that name. I actually couldn't have been named after my dad at that time because he and my mom were going by different names I was born into a destructive religious cult in Europe. I was actually born in Scandinavia, in Stockholm, Sweden. My dad was a U.S. citizen, is a U.S. citizen. My mom was Irish. They both ended up in the same colony, basically a commune, in Ireland. My dad got involved in this group after the Vietnam War, returning home, being disillusioned with the way society was heading during the Nixon era, and just not too happy with the path that we were going as a society. My mom was in high school and basically dropped out of high school to run away with the cult. Both of them were attracted to this group because of the positive part of it all, which basically was a message of peace, love, God, and a spiritual revolution against the system, basically a new way of being with one another and engaging with one another, which sounds really like an awesome thing. Some people are familiar with this cult. HBO did a documentary a few years ago. So it was called The Children of God at the time. It still exists. It's called The Family. It's a worldwide network. Some people know it because of that documentary. Some people know it because there's several celebrities who have spoken about it. They were born into it. The Phoenix family, River Phoenix, Joaquin Phoenix, Rain Phoenix, their parents were leaders in the group. And Rose McGowan, who's been in the news a lot with the Me Too movement, she was born into it as well. So people know about it's a thing. Like Wikipedia says it's a thing, so it's a thing. It still exists. And so I was born, my dad and my mom ended up getting married, and I was born about a year later in Stockholm, Sweden. My brother was born about a year after that in Dublin, Ireland. And it was around this time that my mom started to question her involvement with the Children of God. This group started in Huntington Beach, California, and a core part of the theology had to do with human sex. And that was part of what they became notorious for in terms of the issues that are kind of troubling and some of them illegal. They also were known for the child abduction that would go on when people tried to leave the group. Children would be kidnapped and hidden in other countries and that type of thing. So it was around this time that some of the practices were going down a slippery slope. They started promoting child sex and a practice that was fundraising and also proselytizing, which some of the European courts, the ones in Italy, called it evangelical prostitution. So they started promoting these type of practices around that time. And that's when my mom started thinking that this wasn't the environment that she wanted to raise two children in. But it was dangerous, so she couldn't talk about it. She didn't talk to my dad about it. My dad brought us to the United States when I was between 3 and 4, right around that time. That's when we started living in Akron, Ohio. My mom showed up about 9 months later, and she told my dad shortly after that she wanted nothing else to do with the cult, and he hadn't yet escaped the programming, and so he wasn't too happy about it. And sometimes I get in the weeds with this story and go down, there's so many kind of interesting details to it, but there was a whole mess around that time, a whole mess that involved courts, it involved allegations of kidnapping, it involved, a lot of, just messy things. The bottom line, my mom had this plan of coming and getting us, bringing us back to Ireland where she had family. Remember, she's, not even 20 years old yet, dropped out of high school. So she got custody of us, but she wasn't allowed to leave the country with us. She wasn't allowed because my dad's rights as a parent were being protected. So here she was with this choice of whether to go back to Ireland without us or whether to stay here, and she chose us. She had the help of an anti-cult group. These groups exist all over the place. They help people like my mom and my dad out of conditions that they were in. And they helped her with legal help and financial help and a social network and that type of thing. They helped get her housing, which we got into Section 8 housing in downtown Akron, Ohio, an apartment complex that still exists to this day. I check on it periodically. They have a website. It's called Channelwood Apartments. It was maintained. It was built, conceptualized, maintained, and still to this day owned by Alpha Phi Alpha, which is a black fraternity. With a chapter from Akron, Ohio, And so it's because of their basically service that my mom, you know, was able to get our first home. So I'll kind of end it right around there with a little postscript. So we lived in Channelwood Apartments. I went to started kindergarten right down the road at St. Mary's. Later on, I went to school at St. Vincent's St. Mary's. They were together. And in Akron, Ohio, St. Vincent's St. Mary's is actually, it's world famous. Anyone ever heard of St. Vincent's in Akron, Ohio? Yeah, if you do, it's because of LeBron James. Yeah, LeBron James. Which I like to say my best friend, LeBron James, who is texting me right now, wishing me good luck as I'm speaking to y'all. But I make that little joke when I talk about this. Of course, you know, he was a whole generation younger than me. But in my mind, I seriously think that we're friends, you know. We're like really good. I know that he would like me, you know. So we went to school there in downtown Akron, Ohio. And just to wrap it up, my dad got out of the cult. He wanted a relationship with us. And through that, you know, he was able to get through the deprogramming and everything. And my postscript is that there's a lot of beauty that came out of this messy story. I mean, a lot of it. For part of my life, I used to think I had like a dysfunctional something. Upbringing, family, or anything. I've worked through all that. I definitely don't have a dysfunctional family. I have an atypical family. Basically, outside of the boundaries that society draws around what a family should look like. For instance, my mom remarried my stepdad in 1980, so I was 5, 6 years old. And shortly after, well, no, it was about 5 years later, their marriage, they were experiencing difficulties and separated, and I was used to seeing my dad on the weekends. And in 1985, it was either 1984 or 85, he recognized that we were missing my stepdad. And so we were all Cleveland Browns fans, and my dad asked, hey, what would you think if I invited Roy over to watch the game with us? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. And my stepdad Roy came over, we watched the game, and I think we even went bowling after the game, and that started this tradition of us hanging out on weekends. And to this day, those two are the best of friends. My wife, Erin, and I have a baby who's under a year old. The first babysitter that we had over was those two. They travel together. On like Wednesday nights, you'll find them at Panera Bread in Columbia catching up with each other on their weeks. You know, So as an adult now, as someone who's also been through divorce that involves children, I can only imagine how awkward that would have been to give and receive this invitation to watch football, you know, in 1984. But I think it was because of the love they had for us that they were willing to, you know, it was just that important. My mom and my stepdad eventually, they got back together, but then they got divorced. But then they actually got back together and got remarried. And then they got divorced again. So those two, in a true story, they're married and divorced twice. You can't say they didn't try to make it work, right? But my dad and my stepdad actually made it work. They found a way to make it work. Those two are still together. So, anyhow, that story, you know, that day that I told it to introduce this activity, I was shaking. It didn't come out nearly as neatly, if this was neat, that particular day. I remember shaking. It was like I was purging things that I had attached shame to. My co-facilitator had to take over for a couple hours through lunch break. I was just a mess. I wasn't used to sharing that, especially out loud with, like, strangers. But it became more normal over time, and the feedback that I've gotten from participants is really kind of sealed it for me, and it became something that I had to do. I had to choose vulnerability when working with the work. I had to actually change my mindset about the work, because at the time, I really wanted people to recognize the injustice that is around us. I wanted white people to recognize their privilege. I wanted them to learn. I wanted them to get it so bad, and I wanted to do that for them or to them. And I had to change my mindset around the work. I had to think about, like, this is also healing for me. I'm a part of this. I need to learn with the groups that I work with. I need to explore with them. I need to continue to dig deeper and beware at any particular time when I think that I've arrived and I can teach them. because it's way too nuanced and messy to actually arrive. So the frame there of partnering with is the most important piece for me. It also became really important because it's a small piece of what I can do to interrupt patterns of racism, because I know when I walk into a room, the markers that I have of difference, I know the narrative that I just told you is not attached to that. That narrative, basically, I can come from the background I came from, and when people look at me, they'll assume the best. They're not going to think, huh, I bet he grew up in the projects with, like, you know, Section 8 welfare. I bet we better keep our eye on him. He probably has some shaky values, right? I'm going to show up, and the narrative of the white picket fence is going to be what's going through people's minds in the suburbs. So sharing that story is a way to interrupt some of those patterns, because I know that if I had different markers of difference, I have three daughters, and I know that their markers around gender are going to create a different lived experience for them. They're going to walk through the world with a different lived experience. Now, if I had all the markers that blackness is attached to instead of whiteness, I know that I would have a different lived experience. I'd be more likely to end up in what they call the school-to-prison pipeline, to be disciplined more severely than my white counterparts. I know that I'd be statistically more likely to end up in prison. And all of that is attached to these external markers of difference that all this really messy stuff is attached to. Really kind of bad stuff that's wrapped up in these systems of injustice. If I had all the markers of blackness instead of whiteness, I really think I would have a very different lived experience. It wouldn't matter if my parents would have never ran away and joined the cult. You know, it wouldn't matter if my parents had, you know, multiple doctorates and spoke seven languages and volunteered, you know, around the world, because all of that kind of evil was wrapped up in these markers, the way we respond to the markers around what we call race. So sharing the story has become extremely important to me. I think the frame, just to simplify it, and I don't mean to make this sound easy because this is the hardest work. How do we interact with one another with and for dignity? It's extremely hard, even though there's only two choices we can make: honoring dignity or violating it. It's extremely, extremely hard work. So that's the goal. I think that we have a video here that'll help us transition that captures a lot of what I'm talking about. First of all, working wherever you are, doing whatever you are, and working to transform the nature of it. For me, it's not about being a social justice educator. It's what's the manner in which I'm doing that? Am I doing that in a manner that's aligned with dignity? Because if not, I could be doing a lot more damage than good. If I'm a gas station attendant, how can I do it with and for dignity? If I'm a parent, I mean, same thing. So there's a video that we're going to take in here to help us process and think about this. And you may have heard of this group before. It's actually a school orchestra that formed in Paraguay, and one of the poorest areas of Paraguay. And it's called Landfill Harmonics. You may have seen it a couple years ago, featured on 60 Minutes. They kind of had their time in the with the media attention and everything, and it's absolutely amazing. The town was built on a landfill, so literally, when we talk about like mess and junk and turning our mess into a message, it's like it's all around. And the town was so poor, the school was so poor that like they couldn't afford musical instruments. So what they ended up doing was working and engaging with what was around them and actually seeing the beauty in what we might call garbage and actually transforming what was right in front of them into something just spectacular. And the fact that it's an orchestra is also a piece here that I think connects with what Matthew was saying directly, in that each of us, you know, operates in a different space every day. However, if we could play in the same key, I would just call it the key, D, dignity, it's something beautiful and amazing can really come out of it, you know, and the violin is no more important than the cello. Together, it's all about doing what we, you know, what we do. in the same key, with harmony, whatever it is, in creating something beautiful together. So do we have the video?
Maribel Ríos Bogado, tengo 13 años y toco el violín.
Me llamo Juan Manuel Chávez, más conocido como Baby, tengo 19 años y toco el chelo. Este chelo está hecho de una lata de aceite, la madera tirada en la basura y las clavijas son de una vieja cuchara para golpear la carne y para hacer el ñoquis. Y suena así.
Una comunidad como Cateura no es un lugar para tener un violín. De hecho, un violín cuesta más que su casa.
En ese grupo acá mismo encontramos un colador de violín. Y de ese empezamos los documentos reciclados.
La familia que acá vive recicla todo lo que hay en la basura y se vende.
No pensaba antes que yo voy a hacer ese instrumento. Y me siento demasiado feliz cuando estoy viendo a un niño que está tocando un violín reciclado.
Cuando ya escucho el sonido del violín, siento como mariposas en el estómago, así una sensación que no sé cómo voy a explicar.
Bueno, la orquesta de instrumentos reciclados es una orquesta que toca instrumentos hechos con la basura.
Sin la música estaría de core libre.
La gente se da cuenta que no tenemos que tirar la basura muy fácilmente. Y no tenemos que desechar a las personas muy fácilmente.
Going to close out our service now with communion. And communion is this celebration, it's a memorial, a remembrance, a celebration of the vulnerability of Jesus, where Jesus says, here's my body, here's my lifeblood. Jesus really saying, I'm not going to hold anything back from the work of healing and being part of the work of healing of the planet, of humanity, of the universe. And so we can come, we're coming to a table, we can gather around the tables at the front here or in the middle, or we can be served at the sides. But as we come, we're coming to the vulnerability of God. We're also bringing our vulnerable selves. And we're really saying, as we eat the bread, as we drink the wine, or the gluten-free crackers and grape juice, that we're saying yes to that vulnerability. We want to engage in the work of healing. We want to partner with God in healing and reconciliation of all things. So let's just bear that in mind. Perhaps even think of ourselves as instruments or as partners with other people that are instruments as we come to the table. Everybody's welcome, and we also have people who will be at the back if you would like to someone to pray with you. Just come in with a burden or something that's weighing heavy on you. We would love to pray with you, so please come and find us at the back there. You can write out prayers at the sides. There's candles you can light as a symbol of prayer, a symbol of your desire for this union with God and union with this mission of reconciliation. Let's just pray and then please come forward. Lord, we thank you for your love and your compassion. Thank you that you are in this with us, not far off, trying to do things to us, or even do things for us, but you are with us, working right beside us. May we, as we come to the table, experience your presence in a profound and real way. Come, Holy Spirit. Amen. So please, come to a table or be served at the sides.